consider any argument for the existence of God, we have to consider not only whether that argument is valid, but what sort of God it would be evidence for if it's correct.
Because these values are not contingent, they're not dependent on the laws of nature. Also, it requires us to believe that a universe not fit for life could never exist.
Okay. Rick, yeah, you said when you look at all the bad things and evil things in the world, that, you know, obviously God doesn't exist and all this kind of stuff, yeah? But let me tell you something about myself, yeah? When I was little, and my mum, she hit me when I did something bad, right? I didn't turn to her and say, you know what, you don't exist, mum. In fact, when my mum hit me, I knew she existed. Yeah? So...
Tonight's question is whether God exists. Obviously, it's one of the biggest questions that we can ask. Some of us will come here undecided, and maybe our speakers will make up your mind if you're in that position. Many of us will come here already committed to a yes or to a no. If we are already committed, it's perhaps less likely that the speakers will change our minds, but we can still get something very valuable from it, and that is an appreciation that the people on the other side are worth listening to, may have worthwhile things to say. One of my favourite letters is one that Oliver Cromwell wrote in 1650 to some very dogmatic Scottish churchmen. He did not ask them to change their minds. He just said, "Think it possible you may be mistaken." And if we come away with that sort of attitude, if we know where we stand but accept that we could still be wrong, then I think we'll have cause to be very grateful to our two speakers, Hamza Andreas Zortzis and Rick Lewis. To introduce our speakers, Hamza is a convert to Islam, he's an international public speaker, author, lecturer and intellectual activist, and he's particularly interested in Islam, politics and philosophy. He's debated with prominent academics and intellectuals on various topics, and he's a senior researcher for AIRA. Rick is the founder and editor of Philosophy Now, which makes him one of the main initiators of a popular philosophical movement in the English-speaking world. He launched a magazine in 1991. Is it really 18 years? It is 18 years. Well, the first ever popular philosophy magazine worldwide. And this initiative facilitated a wave of popular philosophy activity in Great Britain, the United States and elsewhere, which has gone from strength to strength. And he's been a regular guest on philosophy related programs on BBC Radio 4 and elsewhere. So we have two excellent speakers, one on each side, and without further ado, I shall invite Hamza to speak first.
I will start as Muslims do in the name of God. In Alhamdulillah, wassalatu wassalamu ala Rasulillah. I greet you all with the Islamic greetings of peace. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I'm going to go straight into the thick of the argument. I'm going to use two arguments to show to the audience that we have greater reasons to believe in the existence of God, a transcendental personal agent that caused the whole universe, that created the whole universe. And these two arguments are as follows. One, God makes sense of the origins of the universe. And two, God makes sense of the fine-tuning of the universe to permit life. Let me go straight away to the first argument. God makes sense of the origins of the universe. Now, we have all asked, where did we come from? Why is there something rather than nothing? In this light, the British philosopher Derek Parfit, he writes, "No question is more sublime than why there is a universe, why there is anything rather than nothing." Now, typically, atheists have said that the universe is just there, uncaused. In the words of the famous philosopher Bertrand Russell, he said, "The universe is just there, and that's all." Now, if we really think and ponder and contemplate on this perspective, then surely it's irrational. Because that would mean there was an infinite history of past events. Our history is infinite. But can that really be the case? Can we have an actual infinite anyway? Can we have an actual infinite in the real world? And does an actual infinite actually really exist? I would argue that it does not, because of the following examples. And take these into consideration. Example number one. Say you have an infinite number of bananas. If I take two bananas away, how many bananas would you have left? An infinite number of bananas. So it just sounds like bananas to you, doesn't it? Example number two. Imagine you are a lieutenant or a soldier and you want to shoot the wall. But in order for you to shoot, you have to ask the permission for someone behind you to shoot. And that happens ad infinitum, forever. Will you ever shoot? The answer is no. Example number three actually shows there is no actualization of the infinite in the real world. Take 2 points for example. Point number one is Hamza Dzordzis. Point number two is Rick Lewis. Now you could potentially split up this distance into infinite parts, but you would keep on subdividing this distance forever. And there will never be the most infinite part, if there is such a thing. But rather, you can cross this distance, an actual distance. So in reality, what this tells us is that the infinite has no ontological export into the real world, which basically means it just doesn't exist. In this light, the famous Greek philosopher Aristotle, he said, the infinite is potential, never actual, and the number of parts that can be taken always surpasses any assigned number. Significantly, the famous mathematician David Hilbert, he said, the infinite is nowhere to be found in reality. It neither exists in nature nor provides a legitimate basis for rational thought. The role that remains for the infinite to play is solely that of an idea. But events are not ideas, they are real things. So it logically follows we can't have an infinite history of past events. Therefore, the universe had a beginning, and it logically follows the universe has a cause. But this is very philosophical. What does science have to say about this? Well, I would argue that this conclusion is confirmed by physics in the Big Bang theory. According to this theory, physical time and space were created, matter and energy were also created. The four prominent scientists, J. Richard, James E. Gunn, David N. Schramm, and Beatrice M. Tinley, describe the event of the Big Bang as follows. The universe began from a state of infinite density. Space and time were created in that event, and so was all the matter in the universe. But let's think about this word, infinite density. What does that really mean in the English language? That actually means nothing. Similarly, Cambridge astronomer Fred Hoyle, he states that the universe at a point in time was shrunk down to nothing at all. So the proponent of the Big Bang theory requires us to believe that something was created out of nothing. Anthony Kenny, the professor of Oxford University, he says, a proponent of the Big Bang theory, at least if he's an atheist, must believe that the universe came out of nothing and by nothing. But brothers, sisters, and friends, and family, out of nothing, nothing comes. Even atheists recognize this. The famous philosopher David Hume, he said, I never asserted to absurd proposition as that anything might arise without a cause. P.J. Swart, in his publication About Time, he says, if there is anything we find inconceivable, it is that something could arise from nothing. And I believe the following statement from the eminent physicist Sir Arthur Eddington eloquently sums this up. And he says, the beginning seems to present insuperable difficulties unless we agree to look on it as frankly supernatural. So we can conclude from philosophical and astrophysical scientific evidence that there's a cause for the universe. However, this cause doesn't mean it's God. There's a bit of a leap of faith there, a bit of a jump. Let's inquire what is the nature of this cause in order for us to have that conclusion. I believe, one, it must not be subject to time, because it created time and space. Even Stephen Hawking, he says, almost everyone now believes that the universe and time itself had a beginning at the Big Bang. Two, it must be uncaused, as we already discussed the absurdity of an infinite number of anything, and that includes causes. Three, it must be immaterial, because it created material, and the universe is the sum of all matter, of all material. Most significantly, point number four is the thing that makes our hearts explode, our soul resonate, because this cause must be a personal agent. It must have a personality. Take the following points into consideration. This cause is eternal, no beginning, no end. But it brought into existence a finite effect, the universe. So the only way it could do this, if it chose to bring into existence the finite effect. And choice means what? It means it has a will. And if it has a will, it means it has a personality. Also, if this cause is immaterial, the only thing we could think about that's immaterial are two things. One, abstract objects like numbers, or two, minds. But things like numbers don't cause anything. But raise your right hand, just to show that your mind actually does have an effect in nature. So this thing must be like a mind, not a human mind, but rather with cognition and intellect and knowledge, which indicates a personality. So we could summarize the argument as follows. One, whatever begins to exist has a cause. Two, the universe began to exist. Three, therefore the universe has a cause. And the Quran eloquently sums this up. The Quran says, or do they think creation came out of nothing? Or were they the creators themselves? Or did they create the heavens and the earth, the universe? Nay, they have no firm belief. My second argument, God makes sense of the fine-tuning of the universe to permit life. Now, we all believe natural law exists. There's this thing called natural law. But why do the laws of nature exist? And how can we explain the order in the universe and the apparent fine-tuning for the cosmos to permit life? Surely to claim that it exists with no reason is an absurdity. In this light, Professor Roger Penrose, he says, there is a certain sense in which I would say the universe has a purpose. It's not there just somehow by chance. Some people take the view that the universe is simply there and it runs along. It's a bit as though it's just sort of computes. I don't think that's a very fruitful or helpful way of looking at the universe. Now, I would argue it seems more likely that a universe should exist that wouldn't permit life than one that would. However, the existence of a universe that permits your existence, depends on a conspiracy of initial conditions that must have been fine-tuned to a degree that is incomprehensible. Take the following examples. Take them into consideration. Example number one, the expansion rate of the universe. If the expansion rate of the universe differed by more than 10 to the power of minus 18 seconds, which is 1/quintillionth of a second, there would have been no universe. Even Stephen Hawking, in his publication, A Brief History of Time, acknowledges the extraordinary equilibrium in the rate of expansion. And he says, if the rate of expansion 1 second after the Big Bang had been smaller by even one part in 100,000,000,000,000, the universe would have recollapsed before it ever reached its size. Example number two, the Big Bang's low entropy condition. Now, Roger Penrose of Oxford University has calculated that the odds of the Big Bang's low entropy condition existing by chance are on the order of 10 to the power of 10. That's 10 with 123 zeros. And Penrose comments, I cannot even recall seeing anything else in physics whose accuracy is known to approach even remotely a figure like 1 in 10 to the power of 10. So we're baffled here. And there are only three possible explanations. One, it's physical necessity. Two, it's chance. Or three, it's design. Well, I would argue it cannot be physical necessity because these values are not contingent. They're not dependent on the laws of nature. Also, it requires us to believe that a universe not fit for life could never exist. But we have already seen that these constants and values, even if they were changed by a hair's breadth, it means that there will be no universe to permit life. Professor Paul Davies, he states, it seems then that the physical universe does not have to be the way it is. It could have been otherwise. Also, and most controversially, it cannot be chance. Because the chances of the universe to permit life are so high that it will be impossible and irrational to use this as a sufficient explanation for fine-tuning in the universe. But someone may argue, Hamza, but it can be still by chance. Then I would reply, well, why don't you use the same explanation if you woke up one morning and saw 747 in your garden or a pink elephant in your front lawn? It's just irrational. Most importantly, I would argue that it's not just about chance. It's about what the theorists call specified probability. And specified probability is you need a high chance, including plus conforming to an independent pattern. For example, you have a chimpanzee in this room with a computer. You leave him or her overnight. And what you see is, oh Romeo, oh Romeo. Where art thou, O Romeo? Deny thou fiver, deny thy name. A Shakespearean sonnet. And that doesn't make any sense. Fine, you may expect, and you may say, it could have been chance if you saw words like my name, book, dog, tree, house, garden. But since it conforms to an independent pattern of English grammar, you cannot say this was just by chance. So we can easily conclude that we have sufficient reasons to believe that the universe was designed. So let's summarize this argument. One, the fine-tuning of the universe to permit life is due to physical necessity, chance, or design. Two, it's not due to physical necessity or chance. Three, therefore it's due to design. And again, the Quran eloquently sums this up. The Quran says, in the creation of the universe and the alternation of the night and day, and the ships which sail the seas to people's benefit, and the water which God sends down from the sky, by which he brings the earth to life when it was dead, and scatters about it creatures of every kind, and the varying direction of the winds, and the clouds subservient between the heaven and the earth, these are signs for those who use their intellect. These are the two arguments I've used that I think provide a positive, a cogent case for the existence of God, the existence of a creator. There are many other arguments we can entertain during the Q&A, and there are objections to my arguments which I think I have, and I can provide adequate answers to them. But I like to point out that since I've provided a cogent case for the existence of God, and I don't want to preach or tell anyone how to debate, but I believe my premises must be addressed if we're going to talk about a positive case for atheism or agnosticism. The Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon him, said, the cure to ignorance is to ask and learn. And I think in this light, we should proceed. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Thank you for listening.
Thank you very much, Hamza. I now invite Rick to respond and put the opposing case.
Thank you. I'd like to thank Dialogue with Islam for inviting me here to discuss this most fascinating and important of questions with you. Can you hear me all right, by the way? No? Okay. Too quiet. Okay. So God, delusion or truth? It's always good philosophical practice to try to get clear about what a question means before we try to debate it. And we can't hope to establish whether or not God is a delusion unless we are clear what we mean by the word God, and indeed by the word delusion. We may not have to agree every detail of what we mean by God, but we do need to have some sort of shared understanding of the word. So therefore, even though I'm an agnostic, I want to talk to you about the nature of God. Some people might say that we should leave aside questions about the precise nature of God and simply start by establishing whether or not God exists at all. The trouble with this is that the range of possible understandings of the word God is very broad. There might be some meanings of God where we could actually all agree that God exists and shake hands and celebrate having reached a consensus, but actually the difference between our conceptions of God was so wide that our agreement was almost meaningless. So I want to suggest that the nature of God isn't something we can put aside very easily for the sake of argument. On the other hand, if we try at the beginning to say, well, we're only going to talk about one agreed, precise conception of God, then we might leave out a great deal that people want to talk about. So we have to keep reminding ourselves what kind of God we're talking about, and in particular, when we consider any argument for the existence of God, we have to consider not only whether that argument is valid, but what sort of God it would be evidence for if it's correct. For instance, considering the problem of evil, it might be suggested that we can't wrestle with it until we've already decided that God exists. Is God all-powerful and infinitely just and merciful, as both Islam and Christianity claim? The amount of suffering in this world suggests not. But if we leave aside the problem of evil for the time being, then this debate is not about whether the God of Islam exists, but only about whether some much more minimal kind of conception of God exists. Not a God to whom we could pray or who will take an interest in our welfare. If we're talking about this kind of God, a God who creates the cosmos and then stands back from his creation, then we can disregard the problem of evil. It's no longer a problem in this sense. But if we're talking about a just, merciful, and all-powerful God who intervenes in his creation, then we cannot. To illustrate this problem of different conceptions of God, I want to take an example. Most of you will be familiar with a gentleman called Baruch Spinoza. Now, Spinoza, who lived in the 17th century in Amsterdam, was a lens grinder by profession. So you could say his profession was to help us see things more clearly. And let's hope that's the case here. Spinoza wrote in his book Ethics a proof of the existence of God. According to him, we can all agree that God, if he exists, is the greatest entity imaginable, by definition. And a God who existed in the world would be greater than one who just existed inside our imaginations. So Spinoza says that therefore God must necessarily exist. This is the ontological argument. But therefore, Spinoza goes on to say, that entity, God, must include as part of itself everything we see, planets, humans, trees, everything, or else we could imagine a yet greater God who did include these things. Therefore, he proposes that God is the same as nature. There is just one substance, God as nature, and we are all part of God. It's a kind of pantheism. We might come to agree that there is such a God in a Spinozan sense, but would this tell us very much? Both Hamza and I would probably happily exist that nature exists, and because I'm not hung up about mere names, I'd even agree to refer to nature as God, if you like, as many scientists have done in a metaphorical way. And then we could all have agreed that God exists. But in fact, I'd suggest this hasn't got us very far. Of course, there may be something slightly comical about a humanist wanting to discuss the nature of God. You can see this in the novel Catch-22 by Joseph Heller. I don't know if you've read it. Some have. The central character, Yossarian, is chatting with his girlfriend, and they discover that they're both atheists. Yossarian then launches into a bitter and sarcastic attack on the whole idea of God, saying that if he did exist, he must be a cruel, twisted kind of God to explain all the suffering in the world, or else a blundering idiot of a God. And he's quite surprised when his girlfriend bursts into tears and starts punching him with her fists, saying, "Stop it, stop it." And he says, "What's the matter? I thought you didn't believe in God either." And she says, yes, but the God I don't believe in is a wise and caring God, not the horrible God you don't believe in. So therefore, when we consider arguments for the existence of God, we need to consider not just if they are sound, but also what kind of God they would support if true. And I haven't yet come across any argument that would convince me that God exists, and I've seen no evidence in the world that could be explained only by God's existence. Hamza raises a very powerful argument. I don't think that's ultimately successful in the end, but he raises it very well, and it is a powerful argument, the cosmological argument. He says that the universe must have come from somewhere unless it's always been here. And he argues that it can't have always been here because you can't in the real world have infinite sequences of events. I'm not sure about that, but I don't want to argue about it because the consensus among physicists is that the universe is indeed not infinitely old. So we have a point of shared agreement there at the beginning, I think. The consensus is that it goes back to something called the Big Bang about 13 or 14 billion years ago. So let's assume that space and time both begin at that point, as the physicists currently agree. Hamza says that if the universe had a beginning, then something must have created it, and this he calls God. He quite rightly says that the first cause can't itself be caused, or we'd have an infinite regress of causes. And he says that something which is itself uncaused, and which starts the entire universe, must be God. But there are a few problems with this. With the idea that nothing happens without a cause. Firstly, there's no time for a cause at the beginning of the universe. Our idea of cause and effect is that a cause comes before the effect that it's associated with. However, with the universe, there is no time before the Big Bang. Time starts at the Big Bang. So when will there be a cause? Stephen Hawking, the cosmologist, has said, to ask what came before the Big Bang makes no more sense than to ask what is north of the North Pole. And plainly the answer in both cases is nothing. A second problem is that, that's in that not every effect has a cause. In modern physics, in quantum physics, some things do happen without a cause. For example, if you have a sample of radioactive material, then statistically you can say how long it will take for half of that sample to decay. But you can't say when a decay will next take place because it's random. There's no given cause for a given decay to occur. A third problem with the idea of a universe which has a beginning which must therefore have a cause, or a third possibility, perhaps I should say, is Stephen Hawking's own picture of the beginning of the universe. He has a suggestion for how the universe is, which is that it is finite but has finite but unbounded space-time. So this gets around the problem of an infinitely old universe, but doesn't actually have a boundary, which you have to explain. So what does this mean? What is it to be for something to be finite but unbounded? Well, the surface of the Earth is finite but unbounded. You know, you can work out what the actual area of the Earth's surface is very precisely if you want to. But there's no boundary. You can walk across the Earth and you don't come to the edge of the Earth and fall off. So he thinks that space-time is also like that. If you're going back in time, you get to the point which we call the Big Bang, and as you progress in time, then in terms of space, the universe gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and then at some point it starts to get smaller and smaller and smaller again, until eventually you get to a point in time where the space of the universe shrinks to zero again. But he says, well, this is all, if he's right, and he's not even sure that he's right as far as I understand it, at least at this point in the 1980s when he wrote this book, then you don't need to worry about what caused this, because this has always been there, this curved space-time universe. It doesn't actually have a need for a cause, as he sees it. So therefore, I agree with Hamza that no mundane mechanical cause triggered the universe, but it's possible that it was not a cause, but more like a set of conditions, or else that Stephen Hawking was right and it didn't need that. It's just always been there. But if it was a set of conditions, well, let's look at that briefly. Hamza thinks that there was a prime mover, an initial cause, which exhibited will, and so therefore it must have personality. Presumably to show will, it must have a choice, as you said. What choice might that have been? Well, you could say, why did the universe just start then rather than earlier or later? Maybe that was the choice. Well, when else could the universe start except at the beginning of time? Any time it happened would be the beginning of time, by definition. So that question is meaningless. But then you could say, well, why was the universe the way it was? And this brings us on to Hamza's second argument. Why was the universe made in such a way that it would support intelligent life? It does seem that many of the physical constants in the different physical laws of the universe, as we're beginning to discover them, are such that if they'd been different, then life couldn't have arisen. Maybe there couldn't have been stars at all. We're talking about constants like the charge on an electron. Apparently, if that was a bit different, then hydrogen would behave in a different way. Stars wouldn't ignite. There are many, many other examples of this kind, leading some people to say, well, look, this is so unlikely that this could have arisen just by chance, that all the constants were just at the right level for us to be here. Surely this is an example of a creator making a deliberate design here. But there are a number of answers I wanted to make to this. Firstly, if the constants hadn't been as they were, then we wouldn't be here to ask questions about them. I mean, this is the weak anthropic principle. Unless the universe supported life, we wouldn't be here to consider the problem. If you step off the curb and a lorry just misses you by a whisker, and you say, thank goodness, I'm alive. That's so astonishing. Such a small difference and I would have been dead. That's amazing. Maybe it's divine intervention. Well, a lot of people are killed on the roads. You're only asking about it because you were one of the lucky ones. Maybe we're the lucky ones in terms of the fact that the universe has turned out in such a way that we are here to talk about it. Secondly, there's another possibility. The cosmologist Paul Davis, who you mentioned, wrote, for instance, in the New York Times recently, that it could be that what we think of as universal physical laws might not be so universal, but might be more like local regulations. That if you look at the universe from, as he calls it, a God's eye perspective, looking across this vast cosmos, there might be areas within which the physical constants are one thing and other areas where there's something else. And maybe just some of these areas are hospitable to life and we happen to live in one of these areas. Thirdly, talking about these constants which just happen to be at the right value for us to be here, sometimes it turns out with further investigation that they just had to be this way. One of them, which Hamza mentioned, is the rate of expansion of the universe after the Big Bang. Stephen Hawking's A Brief History of Time also contains a brief history of our attempts to understand the Big Bang. And he does have this quotation about how the rate of expansion had to be pretty much exactly what it was. Otherwise, the universe would have collapsed back into itself at an early stage and we wouldn't be here. However, this was a problem for a version of the Big Bang argument, which has now rather been superseded by several successive versions, actually, which he then describes. And he says that the next version that came along involved something called cosmic inflation, which means that it meant that the Big Bang expanded more quickly than originally modeled at the very beginning. This theory of cosmic inflation was brought in to solve various problems that people didn't really understand about how the Big Bang worked. But one of the consequences of this was that the rate of expansion up to the present then turns out to be pretty much exactly on this borderline between what would then, if it had been different, the universe would have collapsed into itself again. So sometimes it seems that you have a really strange coincidence with these physical constants, but then on further investigation it turns out that that's not the case. That it has to be that way, otherwise, you know, other things don't work. So if we're relying on Hamza's second argument here to show the existence of God, then we might end up with a kind of God of the gaps, as it's sometimes called. A God that we introduce to understand, to explain things that we don't quite understand about how the universe works, but then later on it turns out that we find out how they work after all, and then it turns out we don't need God to explain that particular bit of the picture anymore. So therefore, I'd like to say that if there was a prime mover, it didn't seem to show to me to show unequivocal signs of will or personality. But a prime mover or a prime set of conditions for the birth of the universe without a will or a personality would be pretty close to the modern physicist's position, and indeed to Spinoza's position. Some event or set of circumstances which we're still investigating led to the birth of the universe. That process may in the end turn out to be intelligible to us or not, and we may call it God or we may call it an aspect of nature, but either way we're talking about the same thing, and that thing isn't a personal God. And the problem of evil shows that any God with the ability to interfere in the running of the universe cannot be just or merciful. Otherwise we wouldn't have innocent children being swept away by tsunamis or dying of horrible diseases and all the other awful things that happen in the world. Hamza might say, well, God has his reasons and a wisdom which we can't even begin to fathom. I accept this completely. This is an immense, complex universe, and we're small, limited creatures doing our best to understand it all, and we've got a long way to go. But if we're going to agree to give in and say that our intellects are too limited to comprehend everything, then we have to be consistent about this. In other words, we also have to apply that humility to arguments which seem to us to be good arguments for the existence of God. They might be bad arguments after all. We can't tell. So therefore, if we take that route to avoid the problem of evil, then we end up having to agree to be agnostics anyway. I think this is unnecessarily defeatist. 10,000 years ago, we didn't even have writing, and now here we are grappling with the mathematics of how the universe works. Who knows how far we'll have got with these problems in another 10,000 years, if the species survives at all, of course. I think we should carry on trying to understand the universe, and although I haven't heard any compelling arguments for the existence of God, I could be wrong. And if there is a God, what better way to show our appreciation of his creation than to try to understand it to the best of our ability? Thank you.
Well, you've now heard from our two speakers, and it's now time for contributions from you, the audience. We do have a roving microphone, because it's not going to be very, may not be very practical to get it to you, but please do wait for the microphone to come to you. Yes, gentlemen, there, at the end of that panel. So could you raise your hand again to indicate the mic?
Hi, my name is Saeed, and I work in IT. I've got a question to both speakers from a colleague of mine who doesn't believe in God. The question to Hamza is, how much of a problem does the theory of evolution pose to your belief in the existence of God? And the question to Rick, which is related, is to what extent do you propose evolution forms the basis of an argument against the belief in God?
Okay, we'll take a couple more. This gentleman just there.
Hi, my name is Asif. I'm a master's student here at LSE. My question would be to Andreas. I'm wondering, you said there's no such thing as infinity, but aren't you contradicting the Islamic principle or this concept that after we die and once we go to heaven, we live there, or hell, we live there for infinity? So would you say you're contradicting one of the basic concepts of Islam here.
Okay, we have another one, two, three. This is right at the back in the border. Okay, we'll come to you in the next round.
Okay. I'm Shabnam Duramsi, I'm a consultant, and my question is to both speakers. As I understand it, Heisenberg's theory of uncertainty means that the ways in which we dialogue with the universe as observers affects the universe. So it seems to me that our ways of knowledge are totally in question. And I wonder what both speakers have to say about that in relation to the nature of God.
Okay, so we've got three there. And then if you could wait for the microphone at the back, there are two more who are coming on next. So we've got evolution, infinity, and Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. Heisenberg, would you... would you like to answer all three in 30 seconds?
Sure. I'm sure Heisenberg is more handsome than I am. Okay, in regards to evolution, it's very simple. In contrast to my argument, evolution just has been said. It doesn't have a foot in the door. It's billions of years way after. Because I was discussing about the initial conditions of the fine-tuning of the Big Bang, and I was talking about the metaphysical principle of whatever begins to exist as a cause. The universe began to exist, therefore the universe has a cause. Now, with regards to evolution, even the prophet of neo-atheism in his famous book, The God Delusion, Richard Dawkins, he says, we don't have an equivalent explanation for physics. So there's a difference between a biological view on the origins of life and to do with the argument by design and the cosmological argument. So for me, evolution might be a very interesting way to explain the origins of life from a materialistic perspective, but I don't have to peg my arguments to that because my arguments are way before with regards to arguing for the existence of God. Now, with regards to contradicting the concept of infinity, I would specifically say that infinity doesn't exist in the real world, universe as we know it. Concepts like paradise and hell are metaphysical claims and concepts that we only believe in from an epistemological perspective, how to get to know God and what God says via the Quran. There's two differences between the real world and things such as things that we cannot even fathom. That's why the Quran is itself the divine, the unseen, things that we cannot even know. We don't have the keys to this. So, from our analysis from the finite universe, we understand that the infinite just doesn't have any ontological export into the real world. Some mathematicians said that it does exist, but that's based upon axioms and conventions that exist only in the mathematical realm of discourse. We can't export it to the real world, which, if you remember the examples I gave, will highlight this point. The third point, I think, is very interesting in terms of ways of knowledge. How we get to know things and how we get to acquire information. I think for me, and I think this relates to Rick Lewis's very nuanced speech, is that we have to understand the difference between ontological arguments and epistemological arguments. Now, when I was talking about the existence of God, I was talking about a well-known, defined concept of God in terms of his ontological existence. He is a transcendental cause that has a personality, he's a personal agent. Rick was going into the realm of epistemology, how we get to know God. And that's a totally different type of argument, in my opinion. Rather, the debate should be about, is the Quran from God, or how do we know if a book is from God, or how do we get to know God, which is a different type of question. And usually, when I had this debate at the American University of Beirut, and there was a shifting between ontology and epistemology, and we're going back and forward. But you know, I'm happy to address if we do discuss later about how we get to know God and what the nature of God is, including the problem of evil. But with regards specific to this argument, there's a difference between an ontological argument and an epistemological one, how you get to know God. And for me, that would be the need and the necessity to prove that the Quran cannot be explained naturalistically. And that's how I leave it as that. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks very much. Right, over to you, Rick. So, evolution and Heisenberg are compulsory questions for you, but infinity is optional.
Okay. Well, evolution, I think I probably largely agree with Hunter on this one. I think before Darwin came along, the existence of such complicated, subtle organisms as ourselves and the other animal and plant life on the planet actually was a pretty powerful argument for the existence of God. And I think that Darwin's theory, by providing a very compelling alternative explanation of that, removed that argument for the existence of God. However, that doesn't mean that the theory of evolution therefore means that there is no God of another sort. It isn't an argument against the kind of God who simply sets the universe running and then leaves it alone, for instance. Evolution is an argument against certain conceptions of God, but perhaps not against the conceptions of God that we've been mainly discussing here. Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, it's utterly fascinating, of course, and very significant that there are some things we can't know, even in principle, about subatomic particles. The fact that we can't know both the position and the momentum of a particle at the same time, for instance. So there's a limit on our knowledge there. Certainly this is a question about what we can know, it doesn't mean we can't know anything about anything in the physical world, of course, because once you get above the subatomic level, the statistics of the movements of particles and so on, as far as I understand it, are sufficiently reliable that we can say things with confidence about the position of chairs, lecture rooms, planets, each other, and so on. In some sense, it does provide a problem about knowledge, but not such a problem that it undermines all our attempts to gain knowledge.
Okay. Thank you. We'll take some more comments. There's a gentleman right in the back corner there.
Thank you. My name is Rahim. I'm a social worker. Could I ask both of our speakers for their views on the idea that without an objective force of some sort, there is ultimately no right and wrong. Unless you have something that is external to our subjective experience, right and wrong is purely defined by our time and our culture and our place. Thank you.
Thank you. And then lady in white just in front, I think, had a comment.
This question is from a colleague of mine. He's wondering that if God created the universe, then who created God?
Yes, and we have another one. There's a gentleman right at the back there.
Hi, Rick. This is a question for you, Rick, here. I totally endorse the... my name is Fahad. I study physics and philosophy, that was my background. My question for you is that I totally endorse the fact that physicists have a very strong point when they say that if physics can explain the phenomena of earthquake, then why do we need a second explanation? Right. I mean, that's a good question. That's assuming... that is a very good question. But that's assuming that physics does explain everything, both in all the realms that we need to know about. But my question is that why is it that you are creating a fundamental problem with basic concepts, which could explain phenomena, and we do need them to support the general theories. For instance, take in physics, we can't falsify the concept of force, we can't falsify the concept of energy. We say that energy created, say, quarks. But then we find out that, well, quarks came from subquarks, and then we say energy created subquarks. And those arguments are so basic and so fundamental to the understanding of physics. If you rip that apart, it's more fundamental in time-space, that if you rip them apart, you're practically left with nothing. But we need them, but we use them to bring about a consistent understanding of the physical universe. Now, if that argument you assume can be extended to the ontological world, if I, on the other hand, come and I accept that energy exists to an extent, I don't have to, but I do. But if I take this very argument to the level of God, in the sense that how we Muslims describe it to be, and can bring about a very consistent understanding of many questions that you ask that might not satisfy your feelings, but will give us the ability to distinguish between the right and wrong questions, which is the very thing that knowledge is meant to do, then what is the problem with that? Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very much. I'll invite Rick to go first on these three.
Okay. Three difficult questions. Firstly, the question of whether we need something external to us to show us right and wrong. I think broadly that was the question. There's two halves to my answer. Firstly, I'm not sure that the existence of a God would necessarily enable us to know right and wrong, although that is, of course, a popular view. But it's a view which has been criticized right back as far as Plato in his Euthyphro dialogue, where he asked, is an act good because God commands it, or does God command an act because it is good? If an act is good solely because God commands it, then we're committed to saying, well, whatever God commands is good, even if he commands something completely awful. On the other hand, if God commands things because they're good, then we don't need God as a source of our morality, because there's some other source of morality which God himself is conforming to. If there isn't a God as a source of our morality, then I don't think that's an insurmountable problem. It doesn't mean we can just do whatever we like. Of course, the whole of moral philosophy is a series of attempts to explore how we should behave. Most of those attempts don't rely on the existence of a God. And some of those attempts are more successful than others, but there's been a lot of exploration of this. How should we behave? Here we are, supposing there's no God. Here we are. We've got to find some way to get on with one another and to run our society. Imagine two different ways of doing this. Imagine two countries next to each other. Neither of them has a widespread belief in God. In one of those countries, the general view is, well, do whatever you feel like. Do whatever suits you in the spur of the moment. And it's a place where people lie and cheat habitually, they stab one another in the back. It's like the Wild West, but worse. There's never any peace for a moment, because everyone does what seems to be in their immediate advantage with no concern about morality. And in the neighboring country, people do observe some sort of moral code, whether one based on tradition and custom. After all, the word morality comes from mores, the Latin meaning custom. And the word ethics comes from the Greek ethos, meaning custom. They have either morality based on custom, or else they have some moral code which they've just agreed among themselves. This is how we'll treat one another. Is this all right, everybody? Okay, now which of those two countries would you rather live in? Which of those countries would you rather raise a family in? I know which one I'd rather live in, and I think that maybe is all the basis you need in secular terms for morality. Sorry, I've gone on a bit with that one. Sorry.
That's all right.
Who created God? That's a very difficult question, probably one that I should leave to I'm gonna dive out of the way of that one.
And there a challenge for you?
Thank you, that's very interesting. Now, firstly, about objective morality is a very good question. Now, again, well, if you listen to what Rick Lewis was saying, it was an epistemological. How do we get to know what morality is? That wasn't the question. The question is the basis for morality, the ontological status of morality, if you like. And I would argue, if God does not exist, then objective morals do not exist. But since objective morality does exist, therefore God exists. I give you an example. Say we take God out of the question, because God by concept is the only conceptual anchor that transcends human subjectivity. What else is there? If you take God out of the question, we cannot really say rape is 100% objectively morally wrong from a conceptual basis. It doesn't mean atheists do bad things. No, atheists are great people. We're talking about... That wasn't meant to be a joke, by the way. So the point I'm trying to make is this. In absence of that conceptual anchor that transcends human subjectivity, you just have two things. Social pressure, like what Rick Lewis was saying, and evolution or biology. Now, if we look at biology, we're just accidental byproducts of a lengthy evolutionary process. Our morals have evolved, just like our ears or our teeth. And in evolution, we're just animals. And animals don't have a moral paradigm. When you see a lion ripping the neck of a deer and drinking its blood, you don't say, hey, that lion's acting morally. No, you say it's according to its instincts. So surely we can't have evolution, which is ever-changing, as an objective basis for morality. So what's left? Social pressure. I would argue, if you read anything about social history, social constructionism, read a very basic book by William Burr called An Introduction to Social Constructionism, we can easily come to the conclusion that this is dangerous ground. Because that was an excuse, what happened in the 1940s against the Jewish minorities. There was a social consensus that it was okay to say that we can kill the Jews, which we all believe is objectively morally wrong. But we can only really believe that if you believe in a God. Because what else is there as a conceptual anchor that transcends human subjectivity? We're stuck. Now, Rick Lewis talked about Plato's dilemma. The way to break that dilemma is this. It's because God is good. And that's how you break the dilemma. So the second question, who created God? I really love this question. Now, with regards to the design argument, it would be who designed the designer. Now, in the philosophy of science, the best explanation doesn't require an explanation. For example, if I'm 500 years away, we go and we're archaeologists, say, futuristic archaeologists, I don't know what they're going to look like, and we go into a park, Hyde Park in London, and we start to dig, and we see my mobile phone, a bit of cable, a bit of camera. Now, surely the most rational explanation, the best explanation is to say, there was a civilization here. Now, if a skeptic comes along and says, well, I don't think that's true because how did they exist? Who put them there? Where did they come from? What was their color? Those questions doesn't negate the first explanation, which is the best explanation, doesn't require an explanation. Because if we continue to do that, it's self-defeating. We will not even have science to explain the explanation, to explain the explanation of the explanation ad infinitum. Then we wouldn't have any knowledge. Then me and Rick should just go home. So, and the second point is, with regards to who created the creator. Now, if you define from a logical perspective a creator is an uncaused cause, then you're saying, who caused the uncaused cause? It's like saying, my friend John is in hospital and he delivered twins. What are their gender? I want an answer. What are their gender? Sorry? Exactly, the question is nonsensical, it just doesn't apply. That's exactly the point. And obviously, from the cosmological argument, I said, no, whatever exists has a cause, but whatever begins to exist, God never began to exist. Now, with the third argument about falsification, the brother, I think his name is Fahad, an amazing argument. I really like this argument because I could have just got onto the podium and said, I believe in God because it's intuitive. It's inside me, I can feel it. And that's a rational argument. Do you know why? Because there's a consensus almost in humanity. Anthropologically, sociologically, there's many anthropologists now saying if you put kids on a desert island, they're going to believe in a God. So it's intuitive. Similarly, why should I prove my intuitive claims? Science never proves or justifies that the external world exists. It's an assumption. They never question that assumption. Do you know why? They don't have an answer. They have to start somewhere. So if they claim God is irrational because it's intuitive, well, science is irrational because it's also based on something intuitive, which the external world exists. So it's a very basic philosophical premise that we believe that God exists from intuition. Although I didn't use that as an argument, but you can do. And if anyone says to you, well, you shouldn't believe that because it's irrational, well, that goes with any type of philosophy. Every philosophy has an assumption. The assumption of science is that the external world exists and they just take it for granted. Just like we take God for granted. Simple as that. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. We've got time for another round of three questions with the microphone. If you could, the first one, the lady in red there, so if you go up to row six and then across five places.
My question is going to be a bit controversial because I'm going to ask about something that it hasn't been addressed so far. We talk about God, and in my understanding is when we talk about God, sometimes we might relinquish our responsibility. I was brought up in a Roman Catholic religion, but then I also explored Buddhism and the Eastern religion, and I think maybe the God is between us, but I wouldn't want to give the name God. It's about if we start listening to ourselves, we get in touch with nature around us, we get in touch with people around us. You know, there is the lion that kills another animal, there is that part between us, and a lot of religion a lot of the wars happen because of this fight about God. So I think this the people who don't believe in God, what we attach to God, that should have a space and a voice in this setup.
Okay, thank you very much. Then next one, I saw the gentleman in the second row, right at the end of the row.
Thank you. Well, my question to Brother Hamza is, I totally understand the difference between the nature of God and the argument which was supposed to be here, that whether the God exists or not. But what I have seen from Professor Rick is, to most of the arguments you have raised, he has answered, maybe coincidence has to be this way. So, initially he raised an argument about the evil. How do you explain evil if God exists? So because he has gone away from the track, I would like to ask you to answer this question as well, if possible.
Okay, thank you. And there were lots of bids for the last slot. gentlemen here in the middle, please.
My question is to the second speaker. You said that the universe came out of nothing. My question is, who created nothing?
Yes, nothing is a challenging concept, and nobody knows what to do with it, but then he would. Right, Hamza, over to you.
Thank you. Okay, I think if I want to sum up the first question, which is a very interesting question, I think it's in two types, two forms of that question. The first form is, how do we get to know God? The second form is religion and war and disasters. Now, I would argue that in order to know God, we can't really just rely on introspection, because we are based on different genetics, social structure, demographics, historical, geographical background, heritage, etc. And we would have our own conceptions of God, which would be problematic. And we've seen that in history when there wasn't much religion around that actually defined and drank people to a consensus on what God actually is. So if we do rely on just introspection, I think it's problematic, because we're trying to understand this transcendental cause that is a personal agent that created the whole universe. How can we do that? All we know is there's a knocking on the door. We don't know who's behind the door unless it tells us. So the knowledge has to come externally, not introspectively. And I believe that knowledge is the Quran because of other evidences such as the miracle of the Quran. Now, with regards to religions and war, this has been used by the neo-atheists, dogmatic neo-atheists in my opinion, such as Hitchens and Dawkins. They say religion causes war, it's barbaric, it's not good for your life, it's rubbish. Now, I give a simple answer to that. The simple answer is, in the secular history that we know of today, it has been the most bloodiest history on humanity. And it wasn't in the name of religion, it was in the name of secular ideologies. Even if you want to point the finger, look at Stalin, killed 6 million Christians, Pol Pot and others who did things in the name, not of religion, but of other ideologies. Similarly, when they say religion is not good for you, I think that's wrong. That's based on a media hype, a misconception. something based upon the oppression of the historical Catholic Church using the coercive arm of the state to stop anything that was incongruous with its teachings. Hence the Protestant tradition, and we had the 30-year wars, the 80-year wars, the massacre on St. Bartholomew's Day. It was a mess. Christian history is you're drowning in blood. That's why you had the liberal movement, you had the individualist doctrine of rights, etc. But when we look at today's reality on religiosity and religion, there's been studies by sociologists that are pointing the finger to something very positive. Positive correlation between those who believe in a religion to have less sickness, to be healthier, to live happier lives. And some statistics here, for example, just to mention a few. In 2002, Brian Johnson and his colleagues at the University of Pennsylvania Center of Research on Religion and Urban Civil Society reviewed approximately 500 studies that had been published in peer-reviewed journals. And they concluded that a large majority of studies showed positive correlation between religious commitment and high levels of perceived well-being, self-esteem, low levels of hypertension, depression, and criminal delinquency. I had to call my gran and tell her to be religious. It would lower her hypertension. Do you see the point? Similarly, in the Handbook of Religion, there's many books called The Sociology of Religion, and they don't inquire about the intellectual nature of religion, if it has a basis or not. It says, how does it affect our lives? And statistically, you're more likely to be happy and healthier as someone who believes in religion than someone who does not. Now, I leave the third question to yourself, Rick Lewis. Thank you.
There you go, Rick.
Okay, thank you. Yes, the question about the knowledge of God. Hamza said a little earlier that there's almost a consensus on God. If you put people on a desert island, then they'll develop a religion. He also said later that, what we have is a knocking on the door, and how we interpret that in terms of religion, how we find out about God is a huge question. I would say that there's no knocking on the door, and although there is a consensus, it's not a consensus necessarily on the existence of some kind of God, although it obviously is a very widely held opinion. But what is really universal is actually a need for answers to fundamental questions, and the most popular answers to those questions historically have been religious answers, but they're not the only possible answers. Secondly, the question about religion and war and evil and so on. I think terrible, awful things have been done in the names of religions and under the inspiration of religions, and also good things as well. And among humanists, if you look at history, you've got terrible, awful atheists like Stalin, and also good humanists and good atheists as well. Given the vast number of the vast section of humanity which is religious, it's hardly surprising that religious people across history and across the world display the whole range of human behaviors, from the very bad to the very good. And whether religion makes people overall better or not is a difficult question to answer. Maybe it makes them better overall. None of these things affect the truth of whether or not there's a God. That's a separate question altogether. Lastly, the question about who created nothing. I suppose nothing is the one thing that doesn't need creating.
Right, we'll take another round of questions. Where's the microphone? Okay. Gentlemen, just there first.
This question is to Rick. I thought about it actually when you spoke about... I was thinking about what you said earlier in terms of, does God exist, and the proof of it. And actually start thinking about the whole issue about macrophages window, who has more virus. And the reason I thought about that is that it's one of those answers that you don't know until you've sort of tried kind of thing. You also talk about a lot of things about nothing, universe actually sort of happened and that's all to it. If I take your argument, sort of the way I understand an example is I took a piece of program code that's written in Windows and I put on a Mac machine. It's not going to do nothing. It's absolutely not going to do nothing. So for me, I find it difficult so many people to be here today, walking, seeing, and hearing, and actually to be said that you are from nothing. It's just sort of out of my imagination. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. There's a few right at the back. If you could go up to the back on the new right-hand side. Yes. Gentleman who's standing up there at the end of the row first.
Hi there. My name's Rob Gifford. I'm coming at this from a Christian point of view. I'm a Christian, and I came, if you're looking at it from a Christian point of view, obviously I would say this, it seems simpler. It's based on revelation. If you want to know what the Christian God is like, look at Jesus, who is God in human form. When I came, I was expecting, Hamza, you to talk more about revelation. Since I was under, I thought that Islam was more of a, in some ways similar to Christianity, a religion of revelation. And I wondered, you've talked a lot philosophically and ontologically and epistemologically or whatever. I'd like to ask about the concept of revelation in Islam, which is very much at the heart of the Christian faith. And I'd like to ask Rick, then what are you really saying that you see no evidence of design or of a mind behind created order?
Okay. Thank you. Could you take gentlemen? One of the gentlemen up there, please.
Okay. Rick, you said. When you look at all the bad things and evil things in the world, that you know, obviously God doesn't exist and all this kind of stuff, yeah? But let me tell you something about myself, yeah? When I was little, and my mom, she hit me when I did something bad, right? I didn't turn to her and say, you know what, you don't exist, mom. In fact, when my mom hit me, I knew she existed.
My name is Claude. I'm a child of the universe. Just a basic question towards the panel. If God is the beginning, and God is the end, and God knew that when he created man, he gave him the ability to choose right and wrong, why did he create Adolf Hitler?
Okay, thank you. We'll take those, and then we'll probably have one more round.
Okay, I think the gentleman in the front row, and he's quite low, obviously, compared to the rest, is that I agree with him. There are greater reasons to believe that God does exist. And some of the reasons I elucidated today, which is the cosmological argument and the argument by design, which I believe some of the responses that Rick gave, I don't think they were counted philosophically as defeaters. There may be some questions, but I don't think they're defeaters. For example, one of the questions was about causality that is pegged on time. I say no, because my first premise of whatever begins to exist as a cause wasn't a physical claim, it was a metaphysical claim. So there is responses to these questions, but the reason I didn't want to dwell too much into them because we could be talking about just one issue rather than many. So I do still believe that there was no adequate response to the premises that I gave today in today's debate. The second question about revelation, this is a fantastic question. Now, I would argue that the difference between Islam and Christianity from my perspective is that Islam doesn't require you to believe in a book just based on blind faith. For example, I have many discussions with intellectual Christians, and they say, well, the Bible is from God because it says so. I say, but how do you know? Then he says, the Bible is from God because it says so. And then we go into this kind of circular argument. And the way they break the argument, they say, well, you have to break the circle by just allowing Jesus to enter into your heart. And I say, well, what if you don't believe in Jesus in the first place? So there's a problem. So the reason I start off by using philosophical arguments. To be honest, I supported them by two revelations, two verses from the Quran, which summed up the argument itself anyway. But the reason I don't bring revelation to play, because that's epistemology, but I do also believe that the Quran can be a proof for God. Because the Quran, in my opinion, is a miracle. Now, when I say a miracle, I don't say it goes outside of what we perceive to be natural law. Because natural law is what? It's not like something that is gospel truth. Sorry for the pun, I didn't mean it that way. Yeah? But what I'm trying to say is that natural law is just patterns that we perceive in the universe. Now, if something changes the pattern, it goes against the pattern, it doesn't make it a miracle. That's incoherent view on miracles. I believe in the Islamic philosophical perspective of miracle, which is basically an act of impossibility. Or, in more detailed words, an event that lies outside the productive capacity of nature. And the Quran is that. For example, it's a linguistic miracle. It jumps outside of the nature of the linguistic miracle, which is Arabic itself. So when we go to the Arabic language, which is based on a finite set of tools, grammar, words, letters, and we exhaust all possibilities, all combinations, we cannot create the unique literary form of the Quran. So it's an event that lies outside the productive capacity of nature. And it logically follows that it's a miracle, which proves the need for a supernatural agent here. I know it's quite philosophical, but I can't sum up a whole debate in a few seconds. Now, the last point about the problem of evil. I would disagree with the gentleman, because if your mom slapped you, it could be because she wants best for you, or she could be bad. And we can't attribute badness to God. So the way I would personally deal with the problem of evil is that, first and foremost, to believe that evil really, really exists, you need God in the first place. So how can you construct an argument which for the basis of the argument is God, but the argument negates God? It doesn't make any sense, you see. So that way, what you do, you actually explain God's existence and the existence of evil, but you don't have to really explain why. But I would also introduce here that the concept of problem of evil that he was coming out with, which logically follows as this. One, a good God exists that is omnipotent. Two, evil exists. Three, therefore, a good God that's omnipotent doesn't really exist. But that's based on a very Christian limited understanding of God. God is just love, just good. That's a problem. I would even argue, if God was just love, sometimes I don't see it. If God is just good, well, I don't see that all the time either. I mean, spend half an hour in my Greek family, you realize this very quickly. Sorry, Spiros, my brothers in the audience, and my sister and her partner. Anyway, the point is this, is that Islam, I believe the concept of God in Islam is amazing. That alone has made people embrace its philosophy, its teachings, and its way of life. Because we believe God is not just good, not all just good, not all compassionate and all loving, but He's also the one that's all wise, and the one that also punishes, and the one, so many different other names and attributes that we believe who God is. And we could then easily reconcile who God is with what's happening in nature. For example, wisdom itself. If we believe God is all wise, but we can't see the wisdom, it's a logical fallacy to claim, well, I can't see the wisdom, because I've been arguing from ignorance, and you can't argue from ignorance. So the point is, we can easily reconcile God's names and attributes to what's happening in the world. For example, the tsunami, the children that died in the tsunami, we don't have a very atheistic, bleak view on life. That's it, dead, suffering, tortured, oh my God. They don't believe in a God in the first place. But the point I'm trying to make is this, is that for the Muslim, we believe this child is actually in eternal bliss now. Who thinks that's more of a better world view? That the child's in eternal bliss, rather than it lived a life, it's just matter and biology and just evolution, and if it's just matter, then it doesn't matter, does it? So the point I'm trying to make is, even from an emotional point of view, what would you prefer? A view on life which would have no injustice, no end bliss? Or just a view on life that you're always going to complain and you're going to have problems and you're going to see in a very negative perspective? I believe the Quranic worldview, in contrast to the atheistic, agnostic, and Christian worldview, is slightly more positive because we have a greater understanding on who God is, which we can prove via the Quran, and who God is, such as all-wise, all-knowing, all-loving, is easily reconcilable with the problem of evil, which inherently is a problem with Christianity, not other religions such as Islam. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
was a lot of interesting questions there. I'm going to try and take the first two together, and someone asked if I really thought that everything could come from nothing, all the wonderful things we see around us. And the gentleman who asked about revelation said, did I really see no evidence of design behind created order? And the answer is, I don't see unequivocal evidence of design in the world. And at this point, I am going to call on the theory of evolution after all. I don't think it's a theory which shows that there is no God, as I've explained earlier. But it is a theory which I think convincingly explains something remarkable, which is how from a world with no life, we've come to a world which is full of life. And not only that, but full of very complex life, full of life that asks questions about itself and about its place in the cosmos and about how the cosmos works, about whether there's a God and the nature of God and so on. That's a remarkable thing. And the theory of evolution does show how this can come about. So if a purely physical theory can show something so remarkable, something which seems on the face of it so difficult to explain, then I think, well, maybe the other things that science hasn't explained yet can also be explained by physical theories too. So for that reason, I don't see any reason looking around this remarkable, amazing, endlessly fascinating cosmos to think from that, well, there must be a designer. Well, turning to the problem of evil, say how can evil exist in the world? And Hamza says, well, look, the idea of evil comes from God anyway, which takes us back to the idea of God as the source of moral value. Hamza said a little while ago, in response to the Plato's dilemma, which I raised earlier, I said, is an act good because God commands it, or does he command it because it's good? And Hamza says, well, the answer to that dilemma is that God is good. So therefore, God would only command you to do good things because God is good. But I'd like to ask Hamza, when you say that God is good, by what standard of good are you judging him? Surely then you are judging him by an external standard. So therefore, you're saying that it's not just that God defines good, but that God is good by some external standard. And if God is good by some external standard, then we can relate our own morality to that external standard, and we don't need to get our morality from God. And therefore, because it's an external standard, we can also say that some things are evil. Evil is a tricky word, because when we talk about things being evil, we normally talk about, we're talking about not like volcanoes going off and tsunamis, we're talking about the actions of human beings. And the question was raised, well, why would a good God create Hitler? I think that I'd call it the problem of suffering is a real problem for Christianity and for Islam. How could a merciful God allow so much suffering from natural causes, unless the victims are compensated in an afterlife, which as an agnostic I don't believe in anyway, so that's not a compelling argument for me. Maybe if you have a previously existing belief in the afterlife, then maybe it's a sufficient answer to you for the problem of suffering, or I'd have doubts myself. But the problem of evil, the problem of people doing nasty things to each other, in fact, the problem of people doing awful, appalling things to one another, they say, why doesn't God stop that? That doesn't seem like an argument necessarily against the existence of God. For me, because you could have a God who decided to create us with free will and decided that this was overall the best thing to do, and having given us free will had bound himself, or was bound by logic, from interfering with that free will, and therefore had to stand by and watch as we did awful things to one another. So I don't find that a great argument against the existence of God, but I do think that the problem of suffering from natural causes like tsunamis is a compelling argument.
Okay, thank you very much. We'll just take a couple more questions and Hamza's and Rick's responses to them, and then I shall invite the two speakers to sum up. And I've already seen enough hands go up. There's a lady up against the wall. Yes, just there.
Okay, hi, my name is Anna. As an agnostic, I'm assuming you don't actually believe in the hereafter. Therefore, you don't have, like, not in a rude way at all, but you don't have any set morals. All your morals are set by society. For an example of this would be homosexuality, where 56 years ago it was really frowned upon, and now everyone's fighting for their equal rights. So the morals of society is constantly changing. How do you set yourself limits? And if you do, why? If you're never going to get rewarded or punished for anything other than yourself, you have no purpose in this life.
Okay, thank you. And then there's, if you come down to about the fifth row, there's a lady. The lady there, yes, thank you.
My name's Nozomi, and I'm a music student, and I guess to me the argument is that over time people's kind of like, you know, philosophies and minds change as well, and books like these ancient religious books, you can't read it and take it exactly as they are. That's my argument. And my question is, if the universe needs an explanation, then why does God, if the universe needs an explanation, then why can God not have an explanation and just be God? Why must you have to explain the universe but not have to explain God? I just don't understand it, so I'd like to have that answer.
Okay, thank you very much. We'll just take these two before the speakers do something else. Rick, how do you set your limits? And probably more one for Hamza, what's this conflict between what needs an explanation and what doesn't? So.
Well, you can't live without morality. You have to have limits. What exactly those limits should be, you have to work out for yourself. And each of us attempts to do that in our own way. I believe we're responsible for our actions and also for the consequences of those actions as far as we can see them. I believe we should avoid inflicting suffering on one another, and that we should treat one another honestly as far as possible. It's such a big subject, I hardly know where to start. It's something that's absorbed me for years. I'm so sorry I can't sum it up more succinctly than that.
Okay, thanks very much. And then one for you, Hamza, this question of why does the universe need an explanation and God not?
Can I address the first question as well?
Yes, of course.
Okay, I agree with the system which is talking about, and who draws the line and where, because it is very important, because we do have this shifting kind of morality based upon social pressures, and this is the problem. That's why I said that God is the only conceptual anchor that transcends human subjectivity. And Rick replied, then you're saying God is good to deal with the dilemma. But the issue here then goes into more of a deeper philosophical question of, you know, we believe also in the theological aspect of revelation. It teaches us about this thing called fitra. We have an innate goodness in us. So we understand goodness, but sometimes we could be skewed and our instincts are deviated, and our moral pathways that are inbuilt in us can be deviated. So therefore, we will require epistemology. Quran, what does it say about life, man, and the universe? So there is a base morality, but then you have to elevate it, and there's other like grey areas. For example, if you read literature, literature was designed, in my opinion, just to grey moral boundaries. You know, do you see my point? And that's why we always have this kind of understanding of, you know, what do we do and how do we do things? So God solves the problem by him being the conceptual anchor that transcends human subjectivity. Now, the other lady, the media student that was saying that philosophy changes, I mean, I don't know if that's an argument against God. It's not. I mean, because sometimes it could change for the better or it could change for the worse. Also, you're saying, why does the universe need an explanation? When you're saying God doesn't need an explanation, well, if you were intended to my argument, I said, you know, God doesn't, I'm not saying the universe needs an explanation. What I'm saying is when I reflect upon certain evidences in the universe, then I come with a certain conclusion. It's not based upon this thing that I need answers. You know, I grew up in a very humanist, philosophical, spiritual type of family. My dad's like a humanist spiritualist, if you like, yeah? Very nice man, just like Rick is a very nice man, in my opinion. And I'm not saying that patronizing. I think this is, you know, very conducive, a very amazing debate. You don't have this. And I think, you know, we should be proud of the fact that we've sat here and we've had a very calm and positive discussion. So I thank Rick for that and everybody else, of course. Now, you know, it's not this primitive thing that you always want answers, and I didn't come from that background either. I thought I had all the answers, but when evidence came across to me, I just inferred and deduced from evidence and came to a certain conclusion. It wasn't based upon the fact that people who have religion, they just don't have the answers, that's why they're like that. And I think that's a very outdated cliche in my opinion, you know. And you also referred to about revelation, you know, why would we believe in a book that's 1400 years old? I mean, maybe if you were to read the books, then you could come to a better, more conclusion. I would argue that you probably haven't read the book in the first place. Because if you had, you would see that the Quran has a solution to both poverty. It has an ideological solution to poverty. I mean, you know, it doesn't stop at saying, love thy neighbor. I mean, what does that mean? It doesn't get you far. What does love mean? And what does neighbor mean? And how do you have mechanisms to implement those values? And the unique thing about Islam and the Quran is that not only it's a set of values, but it's a set of mechanisms that implements those values too. So with regards to like the poverty question, instead of having this geopolitical myth, this liberal economic myth, that basically there's not enough resources and there's not enough needs and therefore there's competition, Islam says totally something different, which says, no, there's limited needs and enough resources. So instead of competition, it creates this macro economy of distribution, and from that we have mechanisms such as the zakat system and other things that improve it. And this is a challenge to the humanists, because the humanists say we don't need religion, because when did religion get something that was already human and make it better? Well, some religions didn't, but one religion that did make something better was actually giving charity. It socialized it, politicized it, made it into an institution, made it into an economic model, and in the words of many historians, actually for the first time on a state level, when Islamic governance was in power, there was no one that was poor. Everyone had food, shelter, and clothing. I think that's an amazing thing. So in response, maybe you should read the Quran.
Okay, thank you very much for that. I'm now going to invite each speaker to spend just 2 minutes, recycle time strictly, summing up and perhaps in particular saying what they've learned from this evening. Hamza.
Okay, I think it's been a very interesting discussion. In summary, my arguments were whatever begins to exist has a cause, the universe began to exist, therefore the universe has a cause. And my other argument was that fine-tuning of the universe can be explained by chance, physical necessity of design. It can't be chance or physical necessity, therefore it's design. I think some of the responses were useful questions, but they weren't counted as philosophical defeaters of my argument. And especially when we went into the argument of nothingness, you know, it's quite interesting because there's more evidence to believe that nothing comes out of nothing rather than something comes out of nothing. So, as David Hume said, who was an atheist, said, why don't you just take the greater evidence? And we always want to grasp our intellectual straws and throw God out the window. But in actual fact, when we're doing that, we're throwing our intellect out the window. Because, you know, as I said, there's more reasons to believe that nothing comes out of nothing rather than something comes out of nothing. And, you know, I think what's useful with the problem of evil argument, I don't think there was an adequate response in my opinion, because, you know, we have concept of a first order good and a second order good and a first order evil and a second order evil, and sometimes evil acts make us have a second order good. For example, when there's cowardice in society, the only way to appreciate courage is by having an element of the first order evil of cowardice. So you have a higher good, which is having courage. Similarly with pain, we won't be able to know God, and in Islam we believe God is the healer. How would you know God is the healer if you weren't in pain in the first place? And we believe that knowing God is more important than pain or suffering anyway, because the question presumes that you're here just to have a nice time. We don't believe that in Islam, we're here to know and love God, which in my opinion, I would have a lot of pain for that, because it's something that's transcendental, something very deep and spiritual, and that's why the problem of evil is a very materialistic argument. Now, what I've learned from today's discussion, I have to admit that this is the first of many debates I've had with an agnostic or atheist that has been, I've learned so much. And not only from his amazing behavior. Not to say that all atheists behave badly, of course. well, then we go into the objective morality again, you know, what is good. No, but that's not the point. The point is this has been conducive to positive discussion. We should continue that way. And I think he would agree with me that we need to transcend the dogmatic atheism of Hitchens and Dawkins and come to a very nuanced discussion, because now is the time for change. And I'm not trying to sound like Obama, but maybe I have his smart. So the issue is, now is really the time for change, because we need to transcend outdated cliches and the rhetoric and come together on the table and have a nuanced discussion, even if we disagree with each other. So that's why I commend Dialogue with Islam and all the other organizers that facilitate today's event, because what I learned was, is I need to probably read a little bit more as well. Thank you very much.
Well, I'd like to agree with a lot of what Hamza said about the need for dialogue and the fantastic work which Dialogue with Islam is doing. I don't know if many of you were expecting before the debate that I'd be, because of the title of the debate, maybe putting forward the same kind of arguments as Dawkins and coming up with 8 knockdown arguments which absolutely prove the non-existence of God. I don't have such arguments. If I had any for you, I would have given them to you. Yet I haven't come across any argument, even in this absolutely fascinating and informative debate, with excellent arguments put forward by Hamza and also the fascinating questions which you raised. I haven't come across any argument to convince me that God exists, and I've seen no evidence in the world that could only be explained by God's existence. However, I'm an agnostic, not an atheist, for 2 reasons. Firstly, I've also seen nothing in the world which is utterly incompatible with the existence of a certain type of God. Not, I'd have to say, the God of Islam or Christianity, but of a God who creates the rules of the universe and then binds himself voluntarily or is bound by logic from interfering with the running of the universe. There could be such a God. William of Ockham said that we shouldn't multiply entities beyond necessity. If we don't have a need for such a God in our explanation, why introduce God into our worldview? I go along with that, and so I'm living my life on the assumption that there isn't a God. But Occam's razor isn't actually a disproof of God. You know, it's possible that there is a God. It's compatible with what we see, at least a God of that sort, I think. The second reason I'm an agnostic rather than an atheist is that I recognize that our reason is limited compared with the awesome complexity of the universe in which we find ourselves, and I could be wrong about my assessment of the arguments which are put forward. The most fascinating thing that came up in the discussion, of course, was the question of morality, I think. Already said, I think there are problems anyway with deriving morality from the existence of God. But without God, then what do we do to base our morality? I think it's absolutely a pressing question. It's not one that can be answered by society, it's one that has to be answered by each of us individually. We have to find a way to get along. It's not a question you can find a way around. But I believe that's the start of a very long and interesting debate, not the end of one.
I think it went pretty well. I was especially pleased that the audience participated. They stuck to the points, they gave well-focused questions, and we got pretty decent answers from the speakers as well. I mean, to me, that's the important thing about it, that we do have a good dialogue and involve everybody.
And do you think that events like this should continue in the future, with like mixed faith groups and trying to debate about topics such as these?
Definitely. I think it's incredibly important that you do keep the dialogue going and that we don't fall into our own little cells in which we don't know what other people are doing. And especially important is that we realise that although we know where we stand, we recognise another point of view, and that we, or the other people, might be mistaken.
And are you going to be involved in any upcoming events such as this?
I'd be very happy to, yes. Either as a chair or as a speaker.
Okay, that's it. So how do you think today's event went?
I think it was a very interesting and successful event today, at least from my point of view, because I learned a lot. I had a few of my assumptions challenged.
I didn't hear anything that completely changed my mind about the existence of God, but I certainly have found a lot of things to make me think.
So do you think we should have more events like this in the future?
I hope you have a lot more events like this in the future, because I think that they're great learning experiences. It's great to interact with all these other people who are interested in the same sorts of questions, passionately interested in some cases. And I really think it's mentally stimulating and challenging.
I think the event went really, really well. It shows that Islam has a position, has an argument, has a cogent argument for the existence of God and many other questions that came out in today's debate with intellectuals and academics. You know, gone are the days that we could use outdated cliches that religion is barbaric, backwards and wrong. You know, we should transcend the likes of Richard Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens and really get into the grips of arguments and start to learn them and promulgate them in the public square like we've done today. Similarly, what was very interesting was my last point, I think, which was there's greater reasons to believe that something comes out of something rather than something comes out of nothing. So why do we really grasp our intellectual straws and believe that something came out of nothing? So I think generally the debate was very successful, and I thank Rick Lewis and everyone that organized the debate today.
If I could ask a question to one of the speakers, it probably would be to Rick Lewis. What got me is that he said that, clearly mentioned that he wasn't an atheist, but he was an agnostic. So my question would basically be, if he is an agnostic and that he doesn't overrule God being in existence, then wouldn't it be safer on his part for the hereafter to believe in God anyway? And then taking that route of what would be the most convincing evidences and proofs to which course of life God would like him to live. Because then it would have been a much better way to live, as Hamza already proved that having a religion in someone's life is better in regards to living. And like my thoughts would be that it will be on his benefit rather than anyone else's in regards to the hereafter.
I think this is one up from a starting block. I think the arguments that are brought forward by writers such as Dawkins and his ilk recently have got a lot of publicity. But actually, when you look at their arguments, they carry very little weight. Actually, the arguments proposed today by the agnostics here, or by the philosophers, were stronger than their arguments. And I think that we should move forward, as I said, confidently. People like Hamza are doing an excellent job in bringing the Islamic perspective. And I think that it's gonna actually, from the other side, from the view of the humanists or the atheists, they're going to have to step up their game now.